WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
CBS News Brief. President Trump called today's conversation with Russian President Putin very good and productive. CBS's Ed O'Keefe at the White House.
The hope here was to get the Russians to agree to a 30-day ceasefire that would then lead to talks to end this war. It doesn't appear that the president got that definitively from President Putin.
Israel resumed airstrikes in Gaza overnight because Hamas hasn't agreed to a Trump plan to extend the ceasefire. At the UN, U.S. Ambassador Dorothy Shea.
President Trump has made clear that Hamas must release the hostages immediately or pay a high price. And we support Israel in its next steps.
Meteorologist Grant Gilmore tells us more severe weather is on the way, including dangerous high winds.
26 million people underneath either a high wind watch, high wind warning, or wind advisories. And this is as the system really starts to crank up over the next couple of days. And it begins today.
CBS News Brief. I'm Cammie McCormick.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
For 540 WAUK News, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. As three more Milwaukee public schools close due to lead contamination, district officials are advising parents to get their children tested for lead exposure. The issue presents a first challenge to the new MPS superintendent, Dr. Brenda Casilius. She started in her role yesterday. You can vote today. In-person absentee voting starts today for the April 1st election. You can find out what's on your ballot and where you can vote early at myvote.wi.gov. The statewide ballot features the high-profile Supreme Court race and two other significant contests. Milwaukee County motorists will see some work start soon in Franklin. Starting next week, construction will start on a Highway 100 project. The improvements will impact the road between 36th and 60th Street. Upgrades include pavement replacement and a new multi-use path for walkers and bikers. The Trump administration has launched another investigation into UW-Madison. This time, allegations are that the university continues to work with a nonprofit that aims to boost diversity in doctoral programs. Savannah Tolmie Olson has more.
The president's Department of Education is looking into 45 universities across the country that participate in the PhD project. Now, the PhD project is a nonprofit program that works to recruit more people of color into doctorate programs. Back in February, all universities got a letter saying they had 2 weeks to eliminate any programs that focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion, or they would lose access to federal funding. And last week, the administration announced that 60 universities were being investigated for civil rights violations because of campus protests against the war in Gaza. In that letter, new Secretary of Education Linda McMahon told these universities they could face, quote, potential enforcement actions.
And that's news on 540 WAUK. I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
The Bucks hit the road. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports NBA. The Milwaukee Bucks begin a long road trip, playing five different teams out west over the next 10 days. Tonight, they face the Golden State Warriors. College basketball, while Wisconsin and Marquette get ready for March Madness later this week, the Badger football team's spring practices are underway in Madison. Head coach Luke Fickell talked about the team's offense with a new coordinator, a new quarterback, and a lot of new players.
Obviously, day one, I think most important thing is efficiency to what we're trying to do. Right? I mean, there's a lot of new offense. I mean that in people. I mean that in just, you know, making sure we understand how we got to do things together. I think we're a little bit further along than, you know, I've really kind of spent a lot of time in football the last month and a half, 2 months. It was just some walkthroughs and things, not just training and things like that, but doing a lot of football. And that's going to be real important to us.
That's the Badgers football coach, Luke Fickell, with Sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Mostly cloudy but still mild today with highs reaching 50 degrees. And tomorrow it'll be overcast with showers and storms moving in by the afternoon. High temperatures will hit 50 degrees and slide below freezing overnight. This is going to switch the rain over to all snow overnight and into early Thursday morning. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlau. It's 60 degrees at our studios.
Reviewing the week's legal news with a friend of the court.
Well, I'm looking forward to Saturday morning. I haven't missed one. outstanding, just like being in school.
It has been a week in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. As always, I am delighted. I am honored that you have chosen to spend some of your weekend time with me in discussion.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Saturday mornings from 9 to 11.
When we got our home appraised, we felt robbed. Compared to a similar home right around the corner, our appraisal was $80,000 less.
Latino and Black homeowners are about twice as likely as white homeowners to get low appraisals. If you believe your home has been unfairly appraised because of race or national origin, contact HUD at hud.gov/fairhousing. That's hud.gov/fairhousing. Everyone has a right to fair housing. A public service message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll discuss the upcoming April 1st election with our friends Pat Kreitlow of Up North News Radio and Trigvi Olson, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation, 540 WAUK.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network, where we're all about real news and great conversation. We're having a big conversation this afternoon because, in this lawyer's opinion, Donald Trump has now plunged us into a very real constitutional crisis. He has initiated a coup, and he did so over the weekend. The coup has been happening, but I think now it's not debatable. He may be an elected president, but a president's powers are limited. He is not a king. In America, the law is king. And the law, our Constitution, has some limits to a president's authority. And the branch of government that often decides where those lines are is the judiciary, is the judicial branch. But Donald Trump and his minions have been saying for quite some time that they don't care what the judiciary says. And in fact, his immigration czar, Tom Homan, yes, that Mensa member, said over the weekend, "I don't care what the judges think." Excuse me, this was Monday. On a Fox News interview. "I don't care what the judges think." That's what he had to say. So when we put all of this together, what you've got is an administration that is actively and intentionally violating a court's orders. And not a court's order about some ticky-tacky little thing. A court order about whether or not a president can invoke the Alien Enemies Act at whim and deport people without any due process. That is where we're at. So I'm going to go through the timeline. I just briefly want to remind everyone that the crux of the at least the basic legal issue here is, can a president just say, yeah, I'm going to invoke the Alien Enemies Act, even though we are not in war, and I am going to use it to deport
criminals. Yeah, Meg's having a little bit of technical issues there. Her mic was breaking up, but she's talking about President Donald Trump intentionally violating or willfully violating the Alien and Enemies Act and deporting people without due process. Tell us your concerns. Call in. We want to hear from you. You can call in at 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. Call in and tell us what you think. Maggie's back.
Hey, Cal. Thanks so much for the help there today. Just again, little glitch in the matrix this afternoon. The Alien Enemies Act permits a president to arrest, imprison, or deport people older than 14 who come from a foreign enemy country. It's only been used in the War of 1812 and the first two World Wars. By the way, it was used to intern Japanese Americans. So we're not at war with Venezuela. We're not at war with El Salvador. There's no declaration of war by Congress. So that country isn't a stated enemy or an antagonist. Neither of them are to the United States. It doesn't apply. But that's if we're even having a reasoned argument about the Alien Enemies Act. What has become the much more pressing legal issue, what has amounted to the constitutional crisis, is, of course, the fact that he has defied a court order. Here is the timeline. At 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, Judge Boasberg asked the administration in a hearing what was going to happen in the next 24 to 48 hours. So news that Donald Trump had issued this executive order invoking the Alien Enemies Act late on Friday, that he was planning to deport some like 200 alleged Venezuelan gang members, that had leaked out. And so the ACLU and another organization filed a lawsuit to stop it. The judge convenes a hearing on Saturday afternoon, 5 o'clock, says, what's going on to the government? The government basically said, they're not sure. You think you might want to know that. Might want to be apprised of some facts. At 5:22, the judge ordered a break in the hearing on Saturday so that the government attorney could get the facts and the judge could rule. By the way, at 5:45, a flight took off. So even there, one of these three flights taking off as this hearing is going on, as the court is asking for information from the government attorney who says they don't know, that's just in bad faith. The idea that you would, oh, I don't know, and a flight takes off while you're in the very hearing to determine whether or not the flight should take off is a big deal. Before 6:52 on Saturday afternoon, the judge agreed that the terms of the Alien Enemies Act apply only to, quote, enemy nations, you know, like it says in the law. And since neither Venezuela nor El Salvador are enemy nations, it doesn't apply and it cannot be used to deport these people without any due process. And the judge blocked deportations under it. Here's what he said at approximately, again, this was 6:52, quote, any plane containing these folks that is going to take off or is in the air needs to be returned to the United States. These people need to be returned to the United States. That is when, again, White House officials, according to reporting by Mark Caputo, after those words were said, actually had a discussion about whether to order two of the planes that were in the air to turn around, but the administration chose not to. The judge had issued an oral order from the bench. The administration said, should we do what the judge told us to do? Answer, no, we're not going to do that. That is insane. And again, that hearing began like late afternoon around like 4:30. The first plane took off not until 5:26 p.m. The second plane took off at 6:44 p.m. And here's what's really important, folks. Here's what's really important. The third plane had not yet left. Two planes were in the air when the judge issued the order from the bench. The administration elected not to turn those around. At 7:26 p.m., the judge's written order granting the injunction sought by the ACLU and directing the administration to not deport these people was entered on the docket. That happened at 7:26 p.m. And 10 minutes later, ladies and gentlemen, the flight took off. The third flight took off. The order was entered on the docket 7:26 p.m. At 7:36 p.m., 10 minutes later, the flight took off. And that is the constitutional crisis. To our texter on the text line, I have to repeat this over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Most of our constitutional rights apply to persons, not citizens. So yes, someone here illegally has a right to due process. That is, Texter, why the president had to invoke the Alien Enemies Act, because it is the Alien Enemies Act that strips even someone here illegally, strips the due process rights away from them. So, Texter, you're wrong, and I know you're wrong, because that's not what the Constitution says, and B, that's not how the Trump administration operated. It was a tacit admission that people here illegally are entitled to due process when he invoked the Alien Enemies Act. You see how that all sticks together? Kelvin and Jamie, Kelvin on the board, Jamie, my senior producer listening in, let me know if I'm not explaining that clearly. But again, most of our rights under the Constitution inure to people. That is the word, or persons is the word that is used, not citizens. For example, the right to vote, that's restricted to citizens. But due process, First Amendment rights, those are all attached to persons, whether citizens or not. I don't know where you're getting that from. You need to learn all the facts yourself. So again, this is the point. Those 10 minutes between the entering of the court's order and when that third plane took off, that's the coup. That's the overthrow. That's the trashing of our Constitution. And by the way, again, there were two planes in the air that could have been turned around. The Trump administration knew that. They talked about it. They decided to defy the court's oral ruling. This is apparently what they're all hanging their hats on, that the planes were already in the air. That is absolutely hogwash. So what is being done about this? Todd from DePere wants to know. So the most recent action was that Judge Boasberg told the Trump administration on Monday that they had to respond by noon yesterday with more detailed answers to his questions about, when did the planes take off? When was this communicated? How did you know this? And by the way, Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, has only really addressed the first two planes. They aren't addressing the third plane. And when asked in the Monday hearing about, well, when exactly did the third plane take off? The Justice Department lawyer refused to answer the questions, claiming that he wasn't authorized, claiming national security secrets. The judge offered to do it in a SCIF, in a secured compartmentalized information facility, and that was ignored and declined. So they're saying, we're not going to comply. On Tuesday, the lawyers went back into the courtroom, again, failed to provide the information that was ordered to be provided on Monday. And Judge Boasberg, again, yesterday ordered the Justice Department to send him under seal the information that he has been seeking. That was supposed to be submitted just hours ago, just before I was getting on the air, everybody. And so here is where we're at. Please keep an eye on this. I will continue to discuss. We've got Jason Stein joining me coming up from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, because right here in Wisconsin, we're about to declare our values in the state's next biennial budget. Amy from Madison, we're going to put your question in the hopper. I'll see if I can get to it tomorrow. Keep it locked. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. This great discussion continues after these quick messages. 855-752-4842. 855-75-CIVIC. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
A new choice, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation, 540 WAUK.
Judge Brad Schimmel is an anti-choice politician whose positions are too extreme for Wisconsin women. He supports a pre-Civil War law that bans abortion. But don't take our word for it. Hear it in his own words.
The 1849 ban on abortions, which, by the way, what is squat about that law?
The 1849 abortion ban provides no exceptions for rape or incest.
What is squat about that law?
The 1849 law criminalizes doctors and their patients.
What is squat about that law?
Brad Schimmel supports an 1849 law to ban abortion with no exceptions. Tell Brad Schimmel, extreme politics don't belong on Wisconsin's Supreme Court. Call 262-548-7548. That's 262-548-7548. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Incorporated.
540 AM WAUK presents This Week in Waukesha, now a weekly podcast.
Hey, it's Downtown Danny Brown, and This Week in Waukesha, I have my first double feature podcast with Deanna Trouse of Truth in Common, talking about how we at the local level can address misinformation and build a more informed community and hopefully preserve democratic values in our community and nationwide. It's going to be a great show. Join us, civicmedia.us/shows.
You can find This Week in Waukesha every week online at waukradio.com.
Do you know or work with kids who have special health care needs? Help them live their best lives. Contact Wisconsin Wayfinder Children's Resource Network. Our specialists will connect you with services in your area. Wisconsin Wayfinder is free and confidential. Call 877-947-2929 or visit dhs.wi.gov/wiscway. Connect today. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
A voice for real news and great conversation in Milwaukee. 540 WAUK.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I want to thank all of our texters and the folks participating in the discussion about what I consider to be now a full-blown constitutional crisis. We have maybe witnessed a coup here in this country without a single bullet being fired. I wanted to answer two brief texters. One texter talking about the liberal judge who ordered the Trump administration to turn the planes around. That wasn't a liberal judge. That judge was appointed by George W. Bush. Last time I checked, that's a Republican and a conservative. Just saying. Second question was from Amy. We could just get enough time to squeeze it in here, so I wanted to answer your question. Amy from Madison says this: can any members of the Trump administration involved in the flouting of the court orders be arrested for breaking our laws? Amy, that is the scene that I never want to witness. Technically speaking, the U.S. Marshals Service is the law enforcement arm that is charged with executing judicial orders. But guess who controls the U.S. Marshals Service? The President of the United States. That seems to be where we're moving towards. And I just want to be clear. Courts absolutely have jurisdiction over presidents. Yes, they do. And with that, we are going to bring on my very special next guest, Jason Stein, from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You're going to make us all smarter, because even I, who like a lot of detail and a lot of nerdy facts and a lot of legislative process, even I can get lost, dazed, and confused in the state biennial budget process. So thanks so much for making time, Jason. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start with the basics. When can we start to see the budget hearings really getting underway? If people are interested in this stuff, where should they be looking if they want to keep an eye on things as they develop?
The budget, the governor put forward the budget in mid-February. Any day now we'll get from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau their nonpartisan analysis of the state budget. And then you'll see in April hearings start in the legislature's Joint Finance Committee, which is their budget writing committee. And then the amendments will start in late May, you know, kind of early June. Then you'll get floor votes in, you know, June, maybe into early July. And then, you know, the budget will typically go to the governor's desk late June, early July.
It's a long process. If you have a lot of free time on your hands, you want to watch the hearings, you can find the Joint Finance Committee hearings on Wisconsin Eye. They sometimes are pretty fascinating. Other moments, It's like watching paint dry. But again, that's where you find it. I also, folks, to give you another source, I think Wisconsin Watch does a hell of a job reporting on it. Obviously, the Wisconsin Policy Forum, you have more in-depth, not sort of daily reporting, but you give us the bigger analysis. And most importantly, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, these nonpartisan, apolitical organizations that do these analyses. Again, portions will be very dry, but there will be some highlights in that. And again, their job is to present an unbiased, very objective report of the governor and of the budget that is proposed. So a really good resource. So Jason, let's start with the top line on the proposed budget and the overall fiscal health of the state. People have been talking about these big surpluses for a long time now. Are we still in all signs pointing to good territory, or is the landscape changing?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the landscape is changing somewhat. I mean, we've been exceptionally good. You know, 2 years ago, we had a $7 billion general fund balance. That's, you know, our main set of accounts for the state of Wisconsin that takes in income and sales tax dollars and pays for education, healthcare, University of Wisconsin, state prisons. And that will be down from 2 years ago at the end of, you know, June, it'll be down to about $4.25 billion. So, you know, there's already been a $3 billion drop over the past couple years, and that would intensify under the governor's budget, you know, probably under whatever the legislature puts forward too, I would suspect. You know, the legislature, or the governor, excuse me, in his proposal wants to have spending increases over the 2 years of around 20%. And that is much more than we've ever seen in the past. Even the current budget, which is, you know, at a basically generational high in terms of this percentage spending increase. So you add that together with the possibility of tax cuts, big tax cuts by the legislature that are not necessarily sustainable, and the possibility that we could dip into a national recession as well, given where we're at. I think there's reason to be cautious here in the next few months. Things have been very good for the state. We want it to stay that way. And so obviously we want to spend down some of our surplus, but how much and how many commitments do we want to take on, and can we sustain them even if the economy goes into recession? It's worth thinking about that.
We're going to talk with Jason Stein from the Wisconsin Policy Forum about some of those conflicts between the governor's proposed budget, some of these spending increases in education and other places, mental health resources, the fact that Republicans are saying no. You know, again, budgets, budget surpluses, deficits defined by both revenues and expenditures. We have to look at both columns. And to whom, if you're talking about tax cuts, to whom does the bulk of the benefit of those tax cuts accrue, right? Both on an absolute dollar and sort of an effective tax rate basis as well. We've got, again, Jason Stein with us from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Do you have a question about the state's biennial budget process? Have you ever wondered, what the hell is the Vanna White veto? We'll talk about all of that with our very special guest, Jason Stein. You can join us 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. We're going to keep it locked. We got Pam Yonke coming up with our farm update. We'll be right back with Jason and me and you and your questions. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Real news, great conversation from Milwaukee and beyond. 540 WAUK.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Weather speaks a universal language. I'm Stephanie Hoff for the Midwest Farm Report, along with you on a Monday. Eric Snodgrass is the principal atmospheric scientist for Conduit. He tells us that even during times of global tension, weather brought nations together.
Even through the heart of the Cold War, weather information was still shared by us and the Russians.
Oh, yeah.
We still share weather data with the Chinese. I mean, even you could be in the middle of a war, but we all still share weather data, which is an amazing thing. It's a big, it's a human contribution to understand this one source of risk, the atmosphere. And we do that quite well, which means we're able to run global models. We're able to look at weather all around the world and try to assess and learn what it's going to do next. And so because of that global collaboration, you know, we're able to do what we do and do it well. So yeah, I can watch weather in South America and Australia and all of Asia and Europe and keep a close eye on it.
Eric Snodgrass taking us behind the scenes of how weather forecasters use global information to predict what's coming your way. Eric is the principal atmospheric scientist for Conduit. We'll take a look at closing markets next.
With the push of a button, you could save lives and the livelihood of others in your area. The Midwest Farm Report and the National Weather Service are recruiting citizen scientists to help keep an eye on the sky this season. You can help by taking real-time weather observations on your phone and alerting the National Weather Service about severe weather occurring where you are. Volunteer weather observers play an important role in tracking and relaying vital weather information. To find out how you can become a citizen scientist, visit WisconsinWeatherWatchers.org.
Looking to grow new ideas for your farm? Then visit the WPS Farm Show. For 63 years, farmers have been coming to the show for the latest in farm equipment, services, and technology to boost their business. Don't miss this year's show, filled with ideas to help you grow. Mark your calendar for April 1st through the 3rd at the EAA grounds in Oshkosh. For more information and a full list of exhibitors, visit WisconsinPublicService.com.
On the close Monday from Chicago, grain prices, for the most part, were stronger. Cash corn up 2.5 cents at $4.61 a bushel. December new crop corn up 3 cents at $4.54 a bushel. Cash beans were down 0.5 cents at $10.15.5, but November new crop soybeans closed up 0.5 cents at $10.18.5. Class 3 milk contracts are moving in the opposite direction. The April contract is down 39 cents at 1717 a hundredweight, and the May Class 3 milk contract is down 40 cents at 1733. Class 3 milk goes to make cheese, which followed the downward trend. Barrel cheese closed 6.5 cents lower at $1.62.5. The 40-pound block cheese closed 4.75 cents lower at $1.64.5. For the Midwest Farm Report, I'm Stephanie Hoff.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Mostly cloudy but still mild today with highs reaching 50 degrees. And tomorrow it'll be overcast with showers and storms moving in by the afternoon. High temperatures will hit 50 degrees and slide below freezing overnight. This is going to switch the rain over to all snow overnight and into early Thursday morning. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
It's 60 degrees at our studios.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
More farm-related programs being canceled. Those affect more than $1 billion in purchasing local food from farmers for food banks.
These types of programs, it gets high-quality food to people who need it at an affordable price. It's a win-win-win, and it's just a really good investment in these rural economies.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow, weekday morning 6 until 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Day one, the hardest day, the day you hear.
This is a type of blood cancer.
But day one is just one day. At the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, we are here to help you move past day one.
On day 45, I discovered an online community who shared great tips for in-treatment care.
I missed a lot of school during treatment, and LLS helped me keep up.
To learn more and get help on day 2, day 28, or any day, please visit LLS.org or call 1-800-955-4572.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Wednesday, don't miss our weekly climate check report with Melissa Baldoff at 6:30. And at 7:30, our homeroom segment on the value of public schools in our state.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6.
Welcome back, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We've got Jason Stein with us from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, helping us all understand the state's pretty complicated biennial budget process a little better. Jason, one of the, for the wonks, one of the most frequently talked about little artifact of our budgeting process, infamous artifact, I may say, is what is called the Vanna White veto. And so for all of our listeners at home who haven't ever heard of this, can you explain what it is and how it was most recently used, much to the surprise of many folks?
Yeah, it was surprising, I think, and is surprising to people when they find out how much power the Wisconsin governor has with the veto pen. Formerly, you know, governors like Tommy Thompson actually had the ability to strike out individual letters and words and make new words that had not been there before. That power was eventually removed. But then governors retained the power to still strike out keywords, make new sentences, stitch two sentences together. You know, they could remove the not from thou shalt not kill to completely change the meaning of that sentence. And there was something called the Frankenstein veto that was, again, taking two sentences and making them into one. That was also shut down through a constitutional amendment. But then still, Tony Evers to this day retains, you know, among, if not the most powerful partial veto pen in the country. So he still, you know, really has a remarkable ability to change what the legislature sends him, but it's only for bills that have an appropriation in them.
Yes. And can you explain to people what's the difference between an appropriation and other budget terms that we hear? Do people really need to understand that? Or can we think in our head, it's an appropriation that's spending?
Correct. Essentially, you know, there's money that is set aside in a bill for a specific purpose, an appropriation, and that triggers his ability to have the partial veto pen. And the reason, the thinking to that was that it allows the chief executive of the state, the governor, to have some say with a budget bill about, you know, to lower spending. But, you know, it has also had the effect of giving governors of both parties this ability to set policy through their veto. That is, I think when you explain it to people, they generally are very surprised and shocked at the extent of it.
The breadth of the power of that partial veto. Right. It was most, or perhaps most recently, and perhaps most infamously used by the governor to try to increase educational spending for quite some time. Let's talk about educational spending in this current biennial budget proposal from the governor. We've heard Speaker Voss say in recent interviews that the last biennium saw a once in a generation increase in educational spending. Democrats have argued that that's, while there was an increase in spending, there really had been a slow sort of bleed in educational funding over a very long period. So it was trying to get right-size the funding level. Sure. Tell us what the core conflict is in this budget when it comes to educational funding, and who's right when it comes to this state's investment in public education viewed over the last, say, 15 to 20 years, of course, adjusted for inflation and increasing costs, as you will, Jason.
Yeah. So there's something called revenue limits that limit the amount of funding that school districts can take in from local property taxes and state general school aids on a per pupil basis. And those have been kept tighter than the rate of inflation in recent years, which inflation has been, you know, very rapid. And, you know, school districts have not fully caught up or kept up with that rate of inflation in recent years. And one thing you've had happen is, you know, the legislature in the past has really controlled how much school funding rose with those revenue limits. But increasingly, those are going up more rapidly than the legislature had expected or determined because of local referenda, and especially big ones. You had $250 million one pass in Milwaukee. You had $100 million one pass in Madison in 2024. And so I think, you know, one of the big questions is the legislature is sort of losing control of local school funding. And what's happening then is it's going on to local property taxes. And how are they going to react to that? The governor's reaction is to do a very, very large multi-billion dollar school state aid increase to districts. The legislature is clearly not going to sign on for most of that. What are they going to do in response? And that's kind of what we need to wait and see.
Is there some bit of objectively observable irony, Jason, in the Republicans' current view and there'd been legislation introduced to strip away from local communities their right to increase school funding through referenda, while at the same time arguing for local control? It seems to be a bit in conflict. So that's question one. Question two is, do you have any prognostication? Would you like to go on the record, my friend, and give us where you think the funding might end up, and help us see that in context of what the needs are within the schools? It is somewhere in the middle ground. Is that going to be able to get it done, or are local districts still going to be experiencing a pinch?
Sure. First off, to your question, you know, there has been some legislation in recent cycles to at least pare back referendum opportunities for districts. I mean, I think by and large, though, those really haven't had much significant impact, I would say, on the ability of districts to go to referendum. You know, if the legislature were to do legislation that would really impact that, I don't think the governor would sign it. So in this session, I don't think you're going to see anything happen in that regard. Under the governor had this partial veto that you alluded to in 2 years ago that essentially set up for hundreds of years to come, in theory, a $325 per pupil increase in each, you know, every year in the revenue limit. That really puts some pressure, I think, on both sides to get a deal on education, and not just on that, but on the state budget overall, because if no budget passes, you get that $325 increase, which is maybe like, I don't know, 2.8%, something like that, increase in the average statewide revenue limit for school districts. And that, if there's no additional state aid approved, district school boards could choose to raise property taxes by that additional amount. And I think both the governor and legislature would be reluctant to have that happen. Yes. So maybe that puts a little more pressure on them, both sides, to get a budget and not just have no budget at all. I think the most likely scenario is that school districts are continue to be feel like they have not gotten enough in the state budget, because I mean, you know, they've been pretty unhappy with where things have been at. And, you know, but so you're probably going to see more referenda, which we'll report on the April referenda when those come, when we get those results.
Yes.
And also I think, you know, some unhappy property taxpayers, because you are seeing upward pressure on property taxes because of all this. So we'll see, but that's, I think, probably where the safest money would be for now.
Appreciate that. Again, folks, if you're just joining us, I've got Jason Stein of the beloved Wisconsin Policy Forum with us to delve deep into the state's biennial budget process, which is getting underway. I want to turn to, in just a minute, the trickle-down impacts, an actual trickle-down impact of the federal spending cuts, and where Wisconsinites might see and feel those. Are they making adjustments in the state budget for that? But I wanted to ask you first this question. How common is a biennial budget for state governments? We get it done for 2 years, but I, and this is genuinely, Jason, I have no idea what the answer is, because I'm not super familiar with other state budget processes.
That's a great question. It's been a while since I've looked at it. There are definitely many states that also do a two-year process. There are some that do an annual process. Wisconsin used to do an annual budget. Yep. I think it was in the 60s that we went to a two-year budget. And because it, you know, it's a time consuming process. It goes from like February to July. Yes. So then to be doing that every year, it's a pretty heavy lift. So that's why we went to the two-year process.
Yeah, but I like biennial budgets. Having worked in a local government, there's so much effort and energy that is sucked into those budget processes that, you know, the biennial seems to make good sense. So actual trickle-down impacts of the federal spending cuts. Are we seeing adjustments in the state budget for those? What can Wisconsin residents expect?
I think we're still in the zone of not really knowing what's happening. I mean, you know, and litigation and back and forth. Yes. And there's so many cases and they're somewhat contradictory. Although the results, I have not seen many, if any, results that are suggesting that the administration has broad powers to avoid making expenditures that are essentially appropriated within the federal budget and within federal law. But that being said, there certainly could be a whole variety of impacts to, you know, the state, either because of funding delays or funding cuts that might eventually be approved by Congress. And all this research is available on our website for free if people want to look it out at wispolicyforum.org. But we do have a chart in our budget brief on the state that looks at what the exposure is or what is the level of federal funding by agency. And it's really in the Department of Health Services that you have the big systemic risk for the state. This health services budget is, you know, roughly $40 million. And of that, about $25 billion is Medicaid and food share, which is a successor to food stamp funding and some other programs. So it's really in Medicaid. I mean, the next biggest agency at the UW system is under $4 billion. So, you know, it's almost like an order of magnitude. Or, you know, if you want to think about it, the Department of Health Services has more than really all the other state agencies put together is another way to think about it. So that's really the thing to watch is Medicaid health coverage for the needy, as well as to a much lesser extent, food share funding.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary when you just think of the sheer size of those budget numbers compared to the other line items and departmental spending at the feds. I wanted to cue in on this, and you'll have just about a minute or so, Jason. And that is, how about the uncertainty? Are there any discussions that you've heard of? Are there any mechanisms within state law if funding is, say, in litigation, if there's just uncertainty, if it doesn't get released, do we have other ways to supplement, for example, those funding sources if the money is not forthcoming from the feds?
Well, we do have, you know, this very large general fund balance, which I think retaining some of that could be helpful because it can float us for these things. And a lot of federal funding works that way anyway. It works on a reimbursement basis, as you know, from your time in county government. So I think that's one reason why, you know, the state should really think about retaining some reserves that it can use for that purpose. But in some cases, they may not have under state law the ability to do that. And that's still something we're trying to, you know, get a better handle on.
Jason, it's one of those things. This is all harkening back to like 2020 times. Like, this has never happened before. Everybody's looking around. What do we do now? Gee whiz. Unprecedented is now a very precedented word. Thanks so much to Jason Stein from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You can find out more at wispolicyforum.org. We're going to take care of our last bit of business this afternoon. I'm going to be right back with you about the silencing of the voice of America. Those thoughts coming up next right here on the Meet On Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
Your new choice. Real News. Great conversation. 540 WAUK.
There was a time when barbecue was perfect. A strong, reliable flavor that could be counted on. But then big manufacturers decided that barbecue needed to be zesty or spicy or sweeter or whatever. If you miss the good old days of great tasting barbecue, we'd like to introduce you to Grandpa's Barbecue. Made in small batches from Grandpa's original recipe. Buy yours online today at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
Hi, Chef Grunder. Let's dive right into the machine shed. Fridays here mean all you care to have fried or broiled North Atlantic cod. Or try our bone-in seasoned catfish, lightly fried. More of a salmon lover? Choose between the machine shed's white wine sauce or apple bourbon glaze. Our sauteed savory shrimp will satisfy your taste buds with Old Bay seasoning and Asiago cheese. All great choices. Join us this Friday or every Friday for seafood worth savoring at the shed.
I-94 and Highway 164, Pewaukee.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Folks, we've got to talk about Derek Van Orden. The second-term congressman representing Wisconsin's 3rd District is at it again, dodging public meetings and making all kinds of unhinged comments. As many scramble and struggle to understand the chaos of what's happening in Washington, D.C. and how it's impacting people here in Wisconsin, Van Orden has been as frustrating and disrespectful as ever. In one instance, Van Orden took to social media to berate a veteran who had been fired from his job at the VA by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. And the veteran in question is simply someone who was just reaching out to his congressman, looking for answers. Van Orden's office has also hastily canceled public meetings, and he has made some especially wild accusations about people who have been attending these public events. Congressman Van Orden needs to stop this unhinged madness, and more importantly, be more available and accountable to his constituents.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation, 540 WAUK.
Welcome back, everybody. Can't believe we're already here. End of the day. We got Dom Salvia coming up next right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I wanted to talk about Donald Trump ending, for all intents and purposes, the voice of America. This happened over the weekend. He signed an executive order. Dismantled a bunch of federal agencies, including the agency that oversees Voice of America, as well as Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia. It's pretty shocking. And I get Charlie Sykes's Substack, and he quoted Edward R. Murrow in response to this, and he reminded us that Edward R. Murrow said this: one of our nation's most revered broadcasters, that a nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves. And if you have never heard of the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe or Asia or all any of these things, as well as Radio Liberty, this organization has an annual budget of $270 million. It has more than 2,000 employees. But here's why. It broadcasts in 49 languages across the world and has a weekly estimated audience of more than 361 million people. More people than live in the United States of America. In effect, the cuts have ended Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia, and Radio Liberty. Michael Abramowitz, the director of Voice of America, wrote this on social media. VOA promotes freedom and democracy around the world by telling America's story and providing objective and balanced news and information, especially for those living under tyranny. He added this: for more than 80 years, Voice of America has been a priceless asset for the United States, playing an essential role in the fight against communism, fascism, and oppression, and in the fight for freedom and democracy around the world. Millions of people, hundreds of millions of people every week tune in. And millions of people for the last 83 years have been doing just that. Going to the Voice of America, going to Radio Free Asia, Radio Free Europe for objective coverage as a reliable information source, sometimes about what's happening in their very own countries. During the Cold War, ask your grandparents if you had relatives that were still in Europe through these decades in the Cold War, leading up to the fall of the former Soviet Union in 1988 into 1989. Ask them if they listened to Radio Free Europe. They did. I nearly promise you that. Radio Free Europe and these broadcast outlets are amongst the things, the catalyst that helped people in the former Soviet Union oppose that regime. It has inspired dissident movements to fight autocrats and dictators across the world. Charlie Sykes shared in his Substack that his own parents were among the many Soviet citizens from that period of time who clandestinely listened to Voice of America broadcasts and Radio Free Europe broadcasts, and that helped solidify their opposition to the Soviet regime, to that dictatorship. And of course, unsurprisingly, who was celebrating the end of Radio Free Asia, Radio Free Europe, Liberty Radio, and Voice of America? Ah, yes. Russian propagandists and Chinese propagandists. As the Russian opposition leader Vladimir Kara-Murza put it, this move by the Trump administration is, quote, one more champagne bottle opened in the Kremlin. It further estranges the Trump administration from our Western allies, from other liberal democracies, and aligns us and Donald Trump ever more with despots and autocrats like Putin and oppressive regimes like Xi Jinping in China. Of course, here's from China, the Global Times, which is a Communist Party newspaper, denounced Voice of America as a, quote, frontline propaganda tool in a lie factory. Quote, almost every malicious falsehood about China has VOA's fingerprints all over it. Lovely. One bit of a silver lining. You know who Trump appointed to lead Voice of America and now is apparently out of a job? Carrie Lake. So one small silver lining on that cloud. Yes, karma is sometimes, you know, we'll go with Schadenfreude. Little Schadenfreude for Carrie Lake. She's apparently out of a job. That's going to do it for me today. I'll be back tomorrow. You got Dom Salvia up next. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good afternoon. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it is always better when we stand together.
A new choice, Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation, 540 WAUK.
Dom Salvia.
Next time, 617,000 Wisconsin food insecure residents targeted by DOGE. Plus, which voting bloc will be most impacted by the trade war retaliation? Tune in.
The Dom Salvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
Earl Ingram.
Today we are seeing the largest number of humanitarian emergencies since after World War II. We should be expanding our life-saving aid programs, not shutting them down during this time of crisis. I don't care where they come from. They are human beings. We weren't even having this conversation before 7 weeks ago, before Donald Trump took office, before a monster took office.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
CBS News brief. President Trump calls his talks with Vladimir Putin on ending the war in Ukraine productive. CBS's Stacey Lynn.
The leaders agreed to begin negotiations to end the war immediately. They'll take place in the Middle East. Up first will be a limited ceasefire on energy and infrastructure. The Kremlin called the conversation detailed and frank.
Ukraine's president says he needs more details about the talks. Israel resumed airstrikes in Gaza overnight.
Hamas cannot be part of the future in the Gaza Strip.
Israel's angry Hamas won't accept a Trump ceasefire deal. Two astronauts stranded in space are coming back to Earth. CBS's Mark Strassman reports they'll be splashing down soon off the coast of Florida.
A helicopter will lift them up, take them over to the Florida Panhandle, and then they'll be put on a NASA jet and taken over to Houston for a reunion with their families for the first time in almost 10 months.
CBS News Brief, I'm Cammie McCormick.